This episode of Astronomy Cast is brought to you by Swinburne Astronomy Online, the world's longest-running online astronomy degree program. Visit astronomy.swin.edu.au for more information.
Astronomy Cast, episode 358, Sandra Faber. Welcome to Astronomy Cast, our weekly facts-based journey through the cosmos, where we help you understand only what we know, but how we know what we know. My name is Fraser Kane. I'm the publisher of Universe Today, and with me is Dr. Pamela Gay, a professor at Southern Illinois University Edwardsville and the director of CosmoQuest. Hey, Pamela, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Good. We landed on a comet.
We bounced around on a comet.
It's still there. In the end, it landed.
It did. But the fact that it bounced around is even more awesome than the fact that we landed there.
Yeah. And like literally as we're recording this, there's some pictures now of Philae's various bounces and movements across the surface of 67P. So it's just what an amazing week this has been in space and astronomy. Yeah. So
it almost makes up for the prior week. And as Emily Lakdawalla beautifully put it, robots exploring space is human space exploration, where the robots are our eyes, our ears, our hands, and we need to celebrate these wins and consider how much more we can do by welcoming our robot overlords.
Right. And if you love this, next year, two more missions, right? New Horizons going to Pluto, Dawn reaching Ceres. It's going to be another good year for this kind of robotic space exploration. So hang tough. It's going to be fun. All right, well, let's get cracking with this week's episode.
This episode of Astronomy Cast is brought to you by 8th Light, Inc. 8th Light is an agile software development company. They craft beautiful applications that are durable and reliable. 8th Light provides disciplined software leadership on demand and shares its expertise to make your project better. For more information, visit them online at www.8thlight.com. Just remember, that's www.8thlight.com. Drop them a note. 8th Light, software is their craft.
Our focus on female astronomers continues with Sandra Faber and professor of astronomy at UC Santa Cruz. Faber was part of the team that turned up the Great Attractor, a mysterious mass hidden by the disk of the Milky Way. All right, so let's get cracking. So this is part two, Pamela, of our journey into investigating the lives of some modern women in astronomy. Actually, someone recommended, I think Guido Bieber recommended that we also focus on female astronauts down the road. That might be kind of cool too.
Yeah, we've never discussed astronauts.
And we haven't
really
discussed any astronauts, actually. Yeah. So all astronauts. Yeah, we should do a whole other series on astronauts. That'd be awesome. Okay, so Sandra Faber.
Yes.
Who is she?
She is a woman astronomer who's alive and has done amazing things. Like me, she's from Massachusetts. She, according to her Wikipedia page, is from Boston, which a lot of people write Boston even when they're from all sorts of other surrounding places. So I can't say she's necessarily a Bostonian as much as she's from Massachusetts. She went to Swarthmore as an undergraduate, went to Harvard as a grad student, graduated there in 1972. So at Harvard, Sandy Faber was actually one of Vera Rubin's grad students. And from there, she's gone on to have an amazing career where she has bridged both doing amazing science and working on the instrumentation necessary to enable that science. And there aren't a lot of people out there who are both on the making sure the instruments get built and on the making sure awesome science gets done. They work collaboratively all the time, but she is someone who's driven both sides of that equation, working simultaneously on the development of the Keck telescope as well as on the wide field planetary camera for the Hubble Space Telescope. And she may have been the only person insane enough to do both of those things at once.
Now, everyone's favorite pictures from the Hubble Space Telescope, many of them were taken by the wide field planetary camera. Like that's one of the ones that takes some of the prettiest pictures from Hubble.
It has since been supplanted by a whole series of instruments, but that was that first big color image, beautiful pictures, gorgeous, weird corner chopped out of it, that this is a Hubble image because it has a weird shaped camera. That's the WhiffPic camera. She actually had taken a year off to work on the East Coast. She'd been out in California as part of the UCAL system and went to live out east working at the Space Telescope Science Institute when they realized, holy expletive, Batman, something's really wrong with Hubble. And it was her team at Space Telescope Science Institute that worked hours upon hours that we probably don't even want to think about, trying to understand what had gone wrong and how to fix it. And then years later, she was one of the people who went to the National Academies and worked her butt off arguing, well, we fixed it. Now let's keep it in orbit and keep upgrading it. Because after the Columbia disaster, there was plans to scrap the refurbishing mission. And she fought to figure out, how do we get one more shuttle to fly to the Hubble?
Now, you've jumped around a bit.
I have.
Yeah. So let's go back a bit.
I'm excited.
No, it's great. It's great. I mean, what a phenomenal body of work. So let's go back to sort of, you know, some of the earlier stuff that you worked on. As you said, you know, working with Vera Rubin on motions of galaxies, right?
Right. And from there, she went on to be one of the names behind what's called the Faber-Jackson relationship. This is a relationship that was noticed in elliptical galaxies. These are the ones that look kind of like a big old swarm of stars rather than having the pretty spiral structure like Andromeda does. She found, along with her collaborator, that in big ol' elliptical galaxies, there is a relationship between the rate at which stars are orbiting around the center of that galaxy and the surface brightness of that galaxy. And this allows us to start to get at, well, how far away is the galaxy? If you know how bright it appears to be, you can get at how bright it actually is using this relationship by measuring the rate of stars going around, which has nothing to do with how far away it is.
Right. So it's like another one of those cosmic yardsticks that astronomers are always looking for.
It's not the most accurate of them, but it, along with the Tully-Fisher relationship, which works in spiral galaxies, these two different relationships are a first order estimate of this elliptical galaxy, this spiral galaxy is further away than this other with fairly large error bars. And the Faber-Jackson relationship also started to get at what we call the fundamental plane for elliptical galaxies. And this is this phenomena that has since been very well mapped out that describes, if you have a big old elliptical galaxy, the bigger it is, the faster stars will be orbiting its massive center. So you have this increase in orbital rate, the dispersion of the rate at which stars are seen to be going around. You also, for more complicated reasons, these have lower surface brightness. So if you have a small mass elliptical next to a large mass elliptical at the same distance, and you look at their how bright they are per square pixel, the big one is going to be much more spread out, much more diffuse, and have a lower surface brightness. But because it's so much bigger, it's going to have a much larger total luminosity. So you have this larger total luminosity, larger rate of stars going around, larger mass, lower surface brightness. All of this gets tied together. And we use this to define a plane that cuts through the parameters of luminosity, surface brightness, and velocity dispersion.
And so, you know, you've got this situation where the yardsticks that work there, like type 1A supernovae, you can't count on them to go off in the galaxy that you're hoping to study, right?
Exactly.
So if you haven't, like, if you do get one going off in an elliptical galaxy, now you've got some corroboration and you can test your different methodologies. I guess the other method that works at that range is the Doppler, the Hubble, you know,
Hubble flow.
The Hubble flow, the Hubble constant at that point, right? And so the two can kind of help you get at the distance. But
and a large part of what she's done throughout her entire career is trying to figure out how galaxies trace out the large scale structure of our entire universe. She is actually one of a small group of what are called the Seven Samurai. These are seven scientists who are responsible in the 1980s for measuring how a bunch of different galaxy clusters and large scale structure appeared to be flowing towards this thing that is blocked by the disk of our Milky Way galaxy.
Is it UFOs? It must be UFOs, right?
We call it the Great Attractor.
Is it a dimensional portal to another space?
Some people write papers like that. You're triggering bad thoughts. Anyways, the seven individuals, David Burstein, Roger Davies, Alan Dressler, Sandy Faber, however you want to call it, Donald Lyndon Bell, Roberto Terlevich, and Gary Wegner, they all work together studying how galaxies are unevenly spaced throughout the universe and looking at their flow as they appear to have motions that are superimposed on top of the motions that you anticipate just from the expansion of the galaxy. This additional motion on top of, the expansion of the universe, this additional motion that is on top of the expansion of the universe has to come from something. It's gravitational attraction generally. Our own local group is falling into the Virgo supercluster. And then Seven Samurai discovered all of these things falling into the Great Attractor, which, like I said, it's hidden behind the disk of the Milky Way, so we can't actually see what it is, which is really annoying. But whatever it is, looking at the flows of everything towards it, it's about 250 million light years away. It's in the constellation Centauri. And it's just really annoyingly in the disk of the galaxy where we can't see it.
But it's another one of those things, right? Like, it's been given the name the Great Attractor, and it's like dark matter, dark energy, black holes. You get this name, And it just conjures people's imaginations. And so if you just said there's a galactic supercluster that away, and
that we can't see
because it just happens, like bad luck happens to be that it's on the other side of the core of the Milky Way, which completely blocks our view. But the galaxies above the Milky Way and below the Milky Way are all sort of sliding towards this Great Attractor. But it is just a large galaxy cluster. Like, don't panic.
Yes.
It is not going to tear a hole in the fabric of the space-time calliope.
No. And it's really kind of crazy the way people have written some of the most insane papers about all the things the Great Attractor could possibly be. And no, it's just a giant galaxy cluster we can't see. That's it.
Right. Okay. So Sandra Faber worked on really identifying this motion and helping to really show that there is this strange motion of all these galaxies. And just sort of one thing, you know, in the kind of the modern age with these modern infrared telescopes, astronomers have been able to see more and more through this dust and gas that's clogged the disk of the Milky Way. And so they're really narrowing in exactly where this thing is and kind of what it is. So it's becoming less and less mysterious all the time. Again, don't panic.
Yes. We need a big, happy yellow sticker.
Yeah.
Don't panic.
Don't panic. Great. Okay. So worked on that. What else?
So that was what she did in the early 80s. And in 85, she began work on the Keck telescope, working on one of its spectroscopic instruments. This is an instrument, Deimos, that would allow the redshifts of galaxies to be readily determined with high precision. And this is the type of data you really need to start mapping out in even higher detail the galaxy motions that she'd already been working on with her work with the Seven Samurai. About the same time, she joined in the team that was building the Wide Field Planetary Camera for Hubble. So here she is working on the Hubble Space Telescope's imager and working on one of Keck Telescope's spectrographs. All of this in hopes of getting amazing data later on that would allow her to continue mapping out the large-scale structure of the universe. Now, while Keck went along at a fairly good clip and went fairly successfully, although they had a lot of issues initially with their multimirror system, nothing big to stress out about. Hubble didn't quite have as happy a beginning as one might wish.
Well, it's important to note, I think, Keck is, until like just recently, the biggest telescope in the world, right?
Yes.
It's a monster, 10-meter telescope in Hawaii, top-of-the-line, adaptive optics. You know, you couldn't work on a finer instrument and use it for a more powerful purpose. So the fact that she did that and then also worked on something that would do even better than the Keck telescope, the Hubble Space Telescope. But yeah, and so all these hopes and dreams, launched the Hubble Space Telescope. First images came back and...
No. The universe said no. So as Sandy's work figured out, when they ground the Hubble Space Telescope, they didn't grind it precisely right. They brought it to a focus in the wrong place. So while it had a perfectly ground mirror, it was perfectly ground to the wrong specifications. And that meant that in the optical assembly that it was part of, they couldn't get the telescope in focus. And not being able to get a telescope in focus, and in this case, it wasn't that it was just out of focus, move the eyepiece in and out, moral equivalent of moving the camera in and out. No, it had a nasty stigmatism. So this is where different parts of the mirror focused in different ways. And they were able to figure out how to fix this by putting a new corrector lens packet in, but that required a second space shuttle mission. And it was not easy to figure out all of this. And in between these two instances, we also lost the space shuttle program for a few years. So her career was not an easy one, you might say.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, the Challenger, I'm trying to think the timeline, right? So the Hubble was launched, I think, 95?
No, Hubble was launched April 24th, 1990.
So
it came after Challenger.
After Challenger, yeah.
It was one of the first big launches after Challenger. But, okay, let me rephrase that. We didn't lose the shuttle program as much as we lost the planned ability of the shuttle to go grab Hubble and bring it back down to Earth. So Hubble was built and designed prior to Challenger. And Hubble was designed that it could be put back into the cargo bay of the shuttle, brought back down to Earth, and have its instrument packs swapped in and out. It was designed to have new instruments put into it. It was designed to have upgrades. Now, the problem is that after the Challenger disaster, it was decided that it probably wasn't safe to bring down heavy telescopes or anything else for that matter to the planet Earth. This meant that we stopped running the space station-like things, the space labs that were in the cargo bay. We didn't bring things back down to the planet. And that means we couldn't bring the Hubble back down to the planet to fix and repair. And we had to figure out, I was in high school, so I had nothing to do with this, people like Sandy Faber had to figure out, how do we, while in orbit, while dealing with astronauts in gloves instead of technicians in, well, just latex gloves, which are different than space gloves, how do we figure out how to add in a whole new optical kit it wasn't designed for, fix this horrible aberration, and get it back to doing the spectacular science that it was designed to do?
Yeah. Okay, so that kept her busy.
So they were able to get it fixed, and they did get Keck, which Keck Observatory is actually two telescopes. So just to make that extra clear, these are two giant telescopes that were among the first telescopes to use segmented mirrors. They weren't the first, but they were among the first. So she's dealing with brand new orbital technology that flew flawed and had to be fixed. She's dealing with fairly brand new Earth-based technology, and at the same time producing amazing science.
And she's still working. She is.
Yeah, she's 69 years old and still going strong, still sitting on panels, still teaching classes, still doing research.
And she won a pile of awards.
She has. No Nobel Prize. I don't think there's any women alive in physics astronomy who've actually won a Nobel Prize, which is a little sad. But I think she's won just about everything else you can win, which is kind of cool. And she continues to lead teams, which at a certain point, when you get to lead the team, that means you get all the paperwork, but it also means that you get to make sure the science that you want to see accomplished is what gets accomplished. And today she's the leader on the CANDLES project, which is continuing to map out at ever higher redshifts, at ever greater resolutions, the large scale structure of our universe.
That is awesome. So again, I got to ask, have you met her?
Yes, actually I have. I got to meet her when I was a graduate student. She came out to the University of Texas, gave a great talk, and then spent some time sitting around with us graduate students. And I was just a baby graduate student at that point. I was first or second year, and telling us what it was like to work in all of these high stress environments. And it was one of those conversations that kind of leaves you going, oh, great. I thought grad school was really hard. Apparently this is the easy part. But then to listen to her, it was just like, if you believe in something and you are curious and you need to know the answer to your science problem in order for your life to be happy, she didn't phrase it this way. But the message I took away from it was, if you really want to know the answer to a problem, it's worth putting in the time. It's worth living through the stress to get at those answers to those problems, to those scientific questions. And the other thing that she did that really impressed me is she did all of this while being a mom. And you don't hear about that a lot. What you hear about a lot is the woman who decided to put her science career ahead of having children. She didn't do that. She had the family. She did the engineering. She did the science. And while on one hand, it's kind of a bad thing to say that a woman has to try and do it all, she is one of the women who did manage to do it all. And while she didn't always make it look easy, she made it look like it was worth trying to do, because great things are possible.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, I mean, you don't have kids. I have kids, and it is it is always hard, and there's never a time when it's easy. And so, to balance those things all out, partly keeps you grounded, you know, in making sure that you remember why you're doing a lot of the work that you're doing. Now, you know, I haven't been discovering enormous new universe galaxy clusters, but you know, the work is ever present, and you always have this tension between the work that you're doing and the family life, and I think the two definitely sort of influence and help each other out, you know?
Yeah, I don't have kids, but I have a horse, and I know that sounds like a stupid analogy, but like this morning I was out at the barn and the horse I've been leasing, I don't actually own her, the horse I've been leasing was having a complete freak out because snow and things and stuff on the roof, horse, crazy horse. And I had work I had to do. And it was like, okay, I have to make choices. And that's nothing like the choices you have to make when you have children. But Cosmic Quest is really my child. It's my vision. And just trying to have a horse is the limit of my capacity.
Yeah.
I look at the people who have actual children rather than furry children. And I killed all my fish during the International Year of Astronomy. I didn't mean to.
Right.
My tank died brutally. I haven't had fish since the International Year of Astronomy. I don't know how she did it. And this isn't me being blasé. This is me saying, quite honestly, as someone who runs a research team and glued myself to the chair I'm sitting in right now for the past 2 weeks to write grants and everything else to keep my staff funded, I don't know, in all honesty, how someone accomplishes everything that she has accomplished in her life and remain sane. And she was perfectly delightful to work with. And from what I understand, she's the kind of person who knows when to be tough as nails and draw a line in the sand because something's important and when to just be nice. And that's a really hard balance to have. And that was my one experience with her. And that's what I've always heard.
That's really cool. Cool. Well, thank you very much, Pamela, and we'll continue on this conversation next week.
Sounds great, Fraser.
Thanks for listening to Astronomy Cast, a nonprofit resource provided by Astrosphere New Media Association, Fraser Kane, and Dr. Pamela Gay. You can find show notes and transcripts for every episode at astronomycast.com. You can email us at info@astronomycast.com. Tweet us at AstronomyCast, like us on Facebook, or circle us on Google+. We record our show live on Google+, every Monday at 12 p.m. Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, or 2000 Greenwich Mean Time. If you missed the live event, you can always catch up over at CosmoQuest.org. If you enjoy AstronomyCast, why not give us a donation? It helps us pay for bandwidth, transcripts, and show notes. Just click the donate link on the website. All donations are tax deductible for U.S. residents. You can support the show for free, too. Write a review or recommend us to your friends. Every little bit helps. Click Support the Show on our website to see some suggestions. To subscribe to the show, point your podcatching software at astronomycast.com/podcast.xml or subscribe directly from iTunes. Our music is provided by Travis Searle, and the show is edited by Preston Gibson.